Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Carmen Leo. Carmen is the owner of LifeCoaching.com and maintains a thriving practice providing organizations, teams, and individuals with an evidence-based methodology to develop emotional intelligence and emotional self-management skills through coaching and training. Over the last 20 years, he has successfully coached hundreds of clients, from single moms to CEOs, from combat vet Marines to artists, musicians, and writers, from rocket scientists to permaculture communitarians, as well as working with clients within organizations such as Apple, Google, Raytheon, NASA, IBM, onsemi, General Atomics, the Washington Post, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and many others. Carmen was a co-developer in collaboration with Pam Leo of the parenting workshops Meeting the Needs of Children, which in 1995 were published as Pam's seminal book, Connection Parenting. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, my pleasure, Derek. Always happy to support you in doing what you do. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. The other day, you and I were having a discussion, and you said something that made me want to interview you again, which is, quote, "Unexperienced emotion is the glue that locks in place non-productive behaviors," end quote. And then you also said, in other words, feelings that are unwelcome or unwanted, that we are unwilling to feel, are the very things that nail one of our feet to the floor and keep us going around in circles forever.
Yeah. One of my old teachers used to say that first part years and years ago. And that's really part of a two-part corollary pair that are matched. It's exactly, you know, he said unexperienced emotion is the glue that locks in place non-productive behavior. Well, you know, what do we define as crazy? Doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result, right? And my response to that, and it took a while to sort of understand the implications of this. One of the great keys to human liberation is to feel what you feel fully right now in the present moment without being compelled to act it out or dramatize it. And, you know, you see this going on in the world all around us. And every time I do a lot of emotional intelligence work with people, and I should make something very clear here at the start. I'm not a therapist. I was trained as a counselor back in the day, but I teach a very particular skill set, behavioral and emotional self-management around the key dimensions of emotional intelligence. We can talk about what those are at some later date. But one of the pivotal essential skills in life is self-regulation, emotional self-management. So when things happen to us, we have a feeling response. I mean, one of the great pieces of research out there in the world that's very compelling by now is that every decision for action that we make rises out of some ground of feeling. We either want to achieve feeling like XYZ, whatever those goody feelings are, or we want to avoid feeling like, you know, PQR, whatever those are that we dread. And I mean, in fact, this is part of the reason why all the clients that work with me come to work with me. They feel a particular way about the way their life is right now, and they have this notion that they can learn some new skills and they can figure out how to manage themselves and their circumstances differently. As a result of those changes, they would then feel differently about their life than they do right now. And this is universal. All of us, we look in the world and we know something is off, but we don't quite know what it is. You know, and this leads us to that piece, ultimately, you know, unexperienced emotion is the glue that locks in place non-productive behavior. So feelings that we don't want to feel, that we want to avoid, turn out to persist, and they can persist over time. And a lot of times we store them in their bodies. In fact, that's how I, back in the 70s, that's how I got into this body of work. Ultimately was one of the gateways. I'd be working on somebody's shoulder. I did body work, a thing called polarity therapy back in the day. And, you know, I'd be working on somebody's shoulder and all of a sudden tears would come out. And I'm like, you know, I didn't know what to do with that because I was like everybody else. Oh, feel a feeling? What, me? So you know, that's kind of where that begins. One of the pieces that's really tricky for this for us is that we don't have a useful language for this. We don't have a conceptual structure. You know, most of us, we don't even know what is emotional intelligence. How does it work? You know, why is it relevant to me and my life? And, you know, if I do this work, what would that look like? At its core, a simple definition, I use two definitions. One is quite simple, the other's a bit more technical. But at its core, emotional intelligence is about being smart with our feelings and the feelings of other people. I mean, where do we get stuck in life? Inevitably, it's dealing with our own feelings about our circumstances or what's going on, or dealing with the feelings of the people around who are relevant and important in our life. I mean, you look at almost all of the crime that we see, the violent crime, where somebody hurts somebody else, it's because somebody had a set of feelings and they didn't know how to self-regulate. They didn't know how to manage those feelings, and then they acted it out. They dramatized it. They did something to somebody else, rising out of those feelings, right? So, you know, that second part of the corollary, you know, one of the great keys to human liberation is to feel what you feel fully right now in the present moment without being compelled to act it out or dramatize it. Being able to interrupt our behavior is a very, very important skill so that we can settle our emotions, feel what we need to feel, and reclaim our thinking. Because when we get emotionally upset, what happens? Our thinking shuts down. We can't process. One of my old friends used to work in a functional MRI lab. He'd call me up. He'd call me up on a Wednesday. Hey, we're doing brains on Saturday. Want to come play? So I'd go down to his research lab. And you could see in the functional MRIs, and these were all, of course, they were white rat lab, you know, graduate students that had signed consent forms and all of that. But you could see their brains and the activity areas in their brain, and something would flash on the computer screen or video, whatever they were watching, and you could see in the blink of an eye, their cognitive functions would shut right down, the cerebral cortex, the forebrain, and their limbic system, the amygdala, you know, that central emotional core, would light right up. You get all these reds and purples and it turns out we can't function when we're being hurt. We can't think well. And we've all had that experience. You know, somebody attacks us or they do something to us that's cruel and hurtful, and we can't process it. We just freeze. We go home. We tell our spouse. You know, we call our best friend. We tell the story 3, 4, 5 times. By the time we've told it 4 or 5 times, we're starting to discharge the emotional upset. And we're starting to recover our clear thinking. And, you know, that's the point where we all kind of inside ourselves go, oh, yeah, I should have said X, Y, Z. Our clear thinking comes back. We've all had those experiences. So, you know, this is part of what we're up to here, what we want to do. So, go ahead. That's a fair little intro right there.
So I want to get a little bit more explicit about the effects of trauma and what we're talking about in traumatic cases, especially, or childhood trauma cases, especially, what we're talking about when we talk about the feelings that unexperienced emotion. So I'm thinking about, you know, Judith Herman's work, and I'm thinking about what I've written about trauma and how if you are a child in a situation where everything is out of your control and you are your primary caretaker does not have your best interests at heart, or it seems that, you know, as they beat you, oftentimes those feelings, the feelings of complete helplessness and terror, are too big to feel. I mean, so stop any time you want and take over the story. And so it is appropriate in many ways not to feel those feelings when you are 6 years old and incapable of effective action.
Yeah. Yeah.
And okay, so take the story from here.
This is really an interesting thing. So there are several things when we're being badly hurt as children. Number one, we don't have a good sense of what the world is, how it works, how it's supposed to work. All we have is our own experience. Like I was 14 when I made my first real friend outside the family as a kid. His name was David. He had 9 younger sisters. This was a huge family. And the first time I ate dinner at that house, it was absolute chaos, and I could hardly eat. I sat there with my jaw on the floor, my eyes bugging out, watching the chaos of laughter and, you know, one kid. I mean, it boggled my mind. And I understood in that moment that the way my family wasn't like other families. There were very, very different things that were going on. So, you know, all of these things, the behavior that we are driven to as adults rises out of the past, right? So if you think of negative behavior, right? Unsuccessful behavior is caused and learned. Primary causes are unmet needs, lack of resources, which are poor models, absence of trusted teachers, and unexperienced, unprocessed, unintegrated emotion, right? So usually the sequence goes something like this. We're bopping along in our life as a child. Something happens. We have an experience that's really, really painful or uncomfortable, and we don't experience it fully, especially not feeling our feelings, because if it's bad enough, we have no safety. There's no one we trust, and we have no idea how to access that feeling in a safe way. There's no resource for us to help us process. Because of the emotional distress, we can't think clearly about the event, and we have no one we can go to help us discharge, to process, to think well, to problem solve effectively about the experience, right? So frequently we have a thought or a set of thoughts about the event that we just believe to be true. We draw an erroneous conclusion about the experience, then we make some kind of decision. That decision then goes underground. So we don't even realize we've made it or that we continue to carry it throughout our life. We lose awareness of it completely. We just believe this is the way the world is, right? And because these old decisions are both persistent and invisible to us, we never think to question them. We never look to find a way to break them down or free ourselves. So these decisions become and continue to be the foundation for our limiting beliefs. So, you know, if you look at how this works, unmet needs, insufficient resource, unexperienced emotion, and poor thinking all combine to create limiting beliefs that sponsor behaviors that prevent us from achieving our goals in life. These goals can typically, they can be something we want to be, something we want to do, or something we want to have. And if all that's not enough, inevitably, we accumulate the negative judgments from other people, commentary and criticism about who we are or what we're doing. And if we hear those comments long enough, often enough, over consistently over time, eventually we buy into it and we begin to say those things to ourselves. Thus, we begin to believe that there's something wrong with us, that we are not good enough. Now, this is really a very interesting piece at this point, because this is another one of those drivers that's almost universal. Chances are you have the idea, the belief, the notion, a set of feelings that something is wrong with you when you're growing up, maybe even still today. 10,000 times somebody has said some version of, hey, what's the matter with you? And eventually you bought into it. We come to believe that there's something the matter with us, something wrong that we need to fix in order to get better. And this feeling and its attendant belief typically is as deep in us as we can go. We hold it with great conviction and certainty. So if you were and I were working together, if I asked you that question on a 1 to 10 scale, Derek, where is that for you? I mean, sometimes we outgrow it, but where is that sense that something's wrong with you, that you need to fix something to get better?
You're literally asking me now, and that's not rhetorical.
I'm literally, absolutely asking you.
At this stage, okay, so 10 means I feel that a lot, and 1 means I don't feel it much.
That's right. Yep.
Oh, I don't know. Probably, it's not much, 2 or 3 probably. If you would have asked me when I was 26, it would have been 8.
Yeah, right. Well, like I said, sometimes we outgrow this. And, you know, if we get fortunate enough, we find resource. Anybody who finds a really, really talented therapist who pays attention, understand how the human being works, can really, really grow. Well, this is one of the pivot points. At this point, I usually ask people, you know, that's a client, what if that were not true? What if you are, in fact, not broken and do not need fixing? What if you are now and always have been whole? What if what's been missing has been accurate information and appropriate resources? What if what's been wrong is only that you didn't know how to get your needs well and truly met? You know, how would you live your life differently if that were true? How would you treat yourself differently? How would you treat others differently? I mean, this is this monolithic edifice that we come to adulthood with from growing up. What's the old Krishnamurti quote? He says, it is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. Here we are, you know? I mean, this is the stuff that's driving us all. Does that make sense? Does that help poke at the thing that you were looking to poke
yeah,
at?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think this is really helpful. And then two things. One of them is that the reason I chose the 20s, you mentioned therapy, is that I had 12 years of therapy from basically 29, 28 to 40, and that helped tremendously. But the second point I want to raise is sort of an example. It's a fictionalized example because I don't want to share too much about someone, but nonetheless, it speaks to this, and I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about the example I'm going to give, which is when I taught at the prison. Again, this is somewhat fictionalized. When I taught at the prison, I had this one student who almost all of his stories were about some child who was being sexually assaulted and how terrible it was for the child. And sweat would break out all over his face as he would read them. And then he would begin and end every story by saying, "This is fiction. None of this happened to me."
Yeah.
Okay. So then one day class was canceled for whatever reason. And I was already there. So my supervisor said, "Let's go look at files just so you can know what that's like." And we basically chose a random student for me to look at their crime and then follow through some of their file just so I would know how that works. And again, I'm fictionalizing much of this, but it makes an example that the crime this person then did was a sexual assault that was not a normal sexual assault, but instead they kidnapped a woman, and then he and a couple other people basically played doctor, by which I don't mean that she was violated with you know, physical with their genitals, but instead they would like put the blunt end of a pen up inside of her. And and then after a while of this, she asked if she could go home and take a shower. And they said, "Sure, as long as you don't call the cops." And then she, of course, called the cops. And he was arrested a couple days later as though nothing was going on, as though he hadn't done anything. Yeah. And I was really confused about this. And I called a friend of mine who is herself a psychologist and said, "What a weird crime." And she said, "No, if he were 6 and this was in a preschool, or if he's 5 in a preschool and he's doing exactly this behavior, what would you think?" And I said, "Well, I would think that he had been sexually assaulted and he's acting out." And she said, "Well, what difference does it make that he's 50 instead of 6? And so there's my example of of acting out this unfelt emotion. I mean, so take this. Do you see why I brought up this story?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, you bet. So when we get hurt, in fact, trauma very often shuts us down and we get stuck. This is one of the keys in addiction as well. When we begin to enact the addictive behavior, whatever it is, usually we're frozen there. We're stuck at whatever age we started. And usually that's an echo of the originating trauma, right? So, you know, if he got sexually abused at six, guess what? He stopped growing. And because he never got any help, there was part of him that's trying to heal from that, that's still stuck. You know, language pieces, therapists talk about abreaction therapy, and where you feel the feelings from the original hurt back in time. And you know, this is a tricky place, because when like I said a few minutes ago, when we get hurt, our thinking shuts down. We can't process, right? We get hurt severely enough, we get stuck, really, really stuck, and we can't move forward. So, you know, all of it makes perfect sense to me why he was doing that. You know, this is a person who needs therapy and can't be trusted around, you know, someone else, because he's trying to recreate the original circumstance so he can go through and heal those wounds in a safe space. We see the same kind of pattern. You know, I've seen this repeatedly. People get stuck in abusive behaviors, right? They end with one abuser and they go out and they get back in a relationship with somebody else who does the same thing. And this is, you know, how can I crowbar this open? All right. So you look at a little child, right? A little girl, she's out in the playground, she's running around, she's having fun. She stumbles, she falls, and she skins her knee. And there's nobody around. She looks at it, she sees that it's bleeding, there's dirt and stuff, and she looks, and she looks, and she stops, and she sniffles. She stashes that wounding, right, that hurt, and goes back to playing, because there's no resource available, right? But a grown-up walks out of the house or, you know, into the parking lot or whatever, and, you know, especially if it's someone that she knows, she goes running up and she tells me she's crying, she's, you know, but wait a minute, she's just been playing for 15 minutes with that wound without it. We have an internal awareness, just like we have an autonomic nervous system that knows how to send, you know, macrophages and, you know, clotting agents and, you know, all of those things. If we get a cut in our hand, we don't have to think about that. Our body does that automatically. We have the same kind of healing process for emotions. And what that is you tell the story, and you keep telling the story until you get to the emotions and you can empty the feelings out, right? Feel it all the way to completion. Now, it's also possible to get stuck, right? We can get stuck in those feelings if we just do the same thing over and over and over in memory, in our mind, instead of feeling them in our body, then we can get stuck. It's possible to do that. But it's a tricky piece, and it takes time. Look, you know, if you think this is a piece, this is sort of a little bit of a leap, but this is directly related. You know, you have your 20 premises that came out of Endgame that I so admire. I have a thing called the four premises of the human condition, right? So follow me on this. Look at how this works. Premise number one, the universal human intention is to problem solve successfully so we can manage the quality of our experience of life, right? I mean, that's just common sense. That's what we're trying to do. Premise two, the quality of our experience of life is determined by the kind, quality, and intensity of our feelings. I mean, you know, here again, just plain common sense. If you're unhappy and angry and disappointed and frustrated, the quality of your experience of life is going to pretty much suck. But if you feel well loved and you're able to be yourself genuinely and you're able to contribute in a way positively to the people around you, you're going to have a pretty good quality experience of life. Premise number three, the kind, quality, and intensity of our feelings is determined by the degree to which we get our needs met. Right? If you don't get your needs met, you're going to be really, really distressed.
Okay, can we stop on that one for a second? I'm loving what you're saying so far, and I see a difficulty here, not with your idea, but with perhaps implementation, in that one's perceived needs may be different than one's. Okay, I'm thinking of the R.D. Lang line, how do you plug a void plugging a void? And somebody who has some original trauma may think that they need a fix of heroin, or that they need to have sex with this particular person, or that they need to do something else, when what they really need is to do something that will fill that original void.
That will heal the original wound. So this speaks directly to your, which I have loved this idea since the day I got it from you, and I think you got it from someone else. I remember you telling me that once. Toxic mimics, right?
Yeah.
So the heroin fat is a toxic mimic for whatever the healing, the original wound that caused the need for the heroin shot, right? So this actually, this spirals right back into a whole thing, right? So if premise three was the kind, quality, and intensity of our feelings is determined by the degree to which we get our needs met, premise four, the degree to which we get our needs met is determined by our ability to problem solve successfully, that goes right back to premise one. You can see that circularity there. And what I mean when I say problem solve successfully is doing the right thing, not the wrong thing. The wrong thing doesn't work. Now, this is actually kind of tricky and a little bit complicated. So doing the right thing, what does that mean? So follow through in this, because this is not something we can typically stumble through on our own. I mean, some people do, obviously, they figure it out. But most of us need the help, some kind of real significant help. But successful problem solving, right, doing the right thing, the first thing you need is presence. You have to be here now. And you have to have clear, accurate perceptions of the world around you. Then, on top of that, you need clear, accurate thinking, emotional literacy, and emotional intelligence. I have a whole conversation around the distinction between emotional literacy and emotional intelligence. I make a distinction. I hold that emotional intelligence is a subset of emotional literacy, right? So what do we have here? Doing the right thing, successful problem solving, presence, clear perception of the world, clear, accurate thinking, emotional literacy, emotional intelligence. Then egalitarian interdependence. These are reciprocal connections, right? Dignity, communication, relationship, community, right? Equal in both directions. And then the last piece of this is a string that here again is behavioral and it's all connected. And any place this is missing, we're stuck, right? We don't get what we need. Adequate resources, the full expression of our powers of creativity and imagination, our ability to choose freely, yes or no, and rightful action. All of those things connecting, right? If any of those are missing, we're diminished in some way. So to use your, you know, so the child who was sexually abused at four, and that went on until she was 12, right? Now she's 19 and a junkie, right? All of these things, doing the right thing, every piece of that is missing in her life. I mean, she might have one or two. She might have clear, accurate thoughts from time to time. She might, you know, be present. But, she, you know, what has she got? She's got a community that feeds her illness, right? There's no adequate resource. you know, all of the systems in the larger community, the society around us, that should help us get the appropriate treatment to deal with. I mean, look what Portugal did. I mean, that's a classic. You know, they made all of these drugs legal. They decriminalized them all. And if you get caught using, the first thing that you do is you start getting clean needles and good drugs, but you're required to go through a detox program. Get the help you need to stop using, right? I mean, their crime rate shifted. They've been at this for over a decade now. And crimes against property, crimes against violence, I think prostitution went down. There's a whole host of things that started to shift in that culture. You may know more about that than me, but that's the thing that just came to the top of my mind as we're going through. Does that help? Does that make sense? The trouble of mistaking a toxic mimic for something that actually helps us get our needs met, those are very, very different things. And it takes resource connection with people who know the difference.
That's great. And so I'm teaching a writing class online, and just last night one of the students in the class are brilliant, but in any case, one of the students said that she had not done a particular assignment because the assignment was to basically counterpunch, by which I meant you read an article and then you counterpunch at that article by responding to the arguments, doing an exegesis, picking them apart, and using that to launch into your own essay. And she said that the problem that she had with it was that she had that the article itself was gaslighting, and that made her so angry at the gaslighting that she didn't want to write the essay. And I told her that I thought that her response was brilliant. And the reason I thought her response was brilliant, this is a long story, but it's going to have a point. The reason I thought her response was so brilliant is because I think a significant portion of writers and a significant portion of philosophers are not, in fact, writing clearly, but they are recapitulating their own unmetabolized trauma.
Yeah.
And not, in fact, writing clearly. So the big jump I want to make here is how much of society's norms or society's the way that one gets one's needs met in the larger society are, in fact, based on this collective incapacity, unmetabolized trauma.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And part of the evidence that I would agree with you for that is look at the violence, look at the trauma that's being perpetuated in every part of this culture. You know, we've been dancing around this for years and years and years. I mean, there isn't. I have so many. I've got crowds of people in my head screaming. You know, blah, blah, blah. You and I have been dancing around this issue from related and different perspectives for, I think, as long as we've known each other. This world, this industrial civilization, is profoundly broken. I mean, beyond. And I agree with you 100%. It is not salvageable. There is almost no piece of this that works. I mean, everything that we talk about. I mean, food. Look at food. My God. You know, you, I'm sure, know some of my history. I was a vegetarian for years. In fact, you know, Lier was one of the real lifesavers for me. Look at the health and food industry out in the world, what do they tell us to eat? Mostly plants, not much fat, et cetera, et cetera. And it's killing us. Everything that they tell us about food and diet is absolutely ass backwards, and it's killing us. You know, how many type 2 diabetics do I know personally who no longer, they've been insulin dependent for 20 years, and they no longer need insulin because they stopped eating carbs, right? I mean, and it just goes on and on and on. Every piece, education. You know, I know a half a dozen kids that went through, they were homeschooled, and they did not much at all until, I mean, they were smart readers, they were curious, they had fun, but they didn't do any, quote, schoolwork until they were 15 or 16. And then one day they woke up and they decided, I think I want to go to college. Well, what do you want to do? I think I want to do X, Y, Z. And they did the entire 12th grade curriculum, the entire 12 years from public school in about 14 months. How much time wasting is education? Now, you know, and it just goes on. Every time we turn around, we're finding another piece of this culture. Look at the family structure. You know, look at the limits on women. I mean, it just, look at what people are doing to children. This is appalling. I mean, you know this. We're probably in the same boat about all of this stuff. But, you know, what do we do? Well, as far as I'm concerned, the faster it crashes, the better. And what's that going to cost? I mean, look at right now. One of the, I hesitate to use this word because it's not quite what I mean, but one of the benefits, maybe side effects of this coronavirus is it has illuminated in, you know, spotlight every crack in American culture. Everyone. There's no way to hide from it. It's just anything that's cracked or broken is clearly cracked and broken. And you know, only the deniers can pretend that it's not true. I mean, and look at, my God, look at what's going on in the Republican Party. I mean, we can just go on and on and on and on about this. But you get my drift. Does that answer in any way your question?
Yeah, it's yeah.
I'm sorry, total sidebar, but it's. Go ahead.
So I'm gonna go back a different direction.
All right.
I think that all of this topic is so important, and it controls us so much at every level. I mean, I know so many people who are 7-year-olds walking around in 65-year-old bodies.
That's right.
And it... I mean, and I am not in any way suggesting that the student at the prison that I was talking about before should not have been removed from society. I'm not suggesting that, because we have to have compassion for his victims too. And that doesn't alter the fact that effectively they were imprisoning a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And we can project that onto the other people too, but a little bit of a story, and I've told this a couple times before, and I will write about this at some point, that, you know, as my mom was dying, I was her sole caretaker, and I didn't really have a place to, I was taking care of her, especially at the end, you know, essentially 24 hours a day. And one thing I did that I am ashamed of is that on her last night before she entered terminal delirium, I got angry at her. And in retrospect, I mean, one of the things I said to her is, why do you hate me? And in retrospect, and it didn't even take much retrospect, like it took 2 hours of retrospect to realize that in that moment, I was a 6-year-old boy losing his mommy.
Yeah.
And my point is that this doesn't just apply to heroin addicts, and it doesn't just apply to
this is all of us.
This in that moment, I was not receiving the things that you. I'm sorry, I can't remember them in the moment, but I was not receiving the various. I was not getting my own needs met in order to be able to meet her needs, and so I did not have a place to feel and discharge, to use the word that you said, because I was taking care of her full time.
That's right.
I had no place to discharge my own sorrow because I had to be present for her.
That's right.
And I wish I could have lasted 24 more hours, but I didn't.
Yeah. You know, in a perfect world, Derek, you know, you and I might have been friends, and you'd have called me up and said, you know, this, my mother, and, you know, et cetera. And I'd come over and I'd just held you while you cried for an hour. Right. And, you know, Pam Leo in Connection Parenting, I don't know if it's actually in the book, but she talks about this in all of her workshops. She says, you know, ideally in life, we all have two cups. We have a love cup and a discharge cup. And ideally in life, we have a love cup full and the discharge cup stays empty. But almost all of us consistently were walking around with the love cup stone dry and the discharge cup full to overflowing, right? There's not enough connection and resource in us. There's not enough, you know, this is one of the reasons why one of the things that I teach my clients is a peer relationship. It's a listening partnership. How do you get somebody who will not try to fix you or make it better or, you know, give you suggestions or advice, but will just hold your hand, give you attention, and be with you while you feel your feelings, right? And you do that, you take turns. So, you know, I come over to your house and you and I sit down and I give you attention for a half an hour and you just dump core, whatever it is that's on you that's making you crazy. And then when your attention is back and you're ready, then we switch roles and you listen to me and I get to dump core. That is so enormously valuable for all of us, right? The resource that we need is connection with other people. You know, I talk about we have three driving needs. Of course, this is not to displace Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They really are very useful and essential to understand what those are and how they work. But we have three primary needs that drive us. The first is connection. I mean, the deepest truth about us as a species, we're highly evolved as social primates. That's what we are. Without connection and community, we fail miserably. And in fact, that lack can actually kill us. There's a thing called failure to thrive. If infants don't get loved and touched and held, they die. They just die from lack of touch. Right? That's number one. Number two, authenticity. We strive to be, to align with, to express who we are as our most powerful, creative, and unique selves. All of us. And to the degree that we can or cannot do that, that need is driving us. It's really problematic. If we can't, I mean, how many people have ended their marriages because they couldn't be who they were? Or how many people who, you know, have changed jobs or, you know, all of these things? We are who we are and we're not who we're not. And both of those matter. And, you know, the third piece in this is contribution. We are wired to make a positive difference in the lives of others in a way that really matters. And this is both personal and universal commitment. One of the things I've observed over the years working with couples, those couples who do best, and the example I use is a classic case, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. What do? Every weekend, they're out banging nails for Habitat for Humanity. That is a universal commitment to something larger than their own personal life, right? So those three, connection, authenticity, contribution, those drive us, right? And just like Maslow says, we're not going to be worried about, you know, self-awareness and expansion if we haven't got food on the table and our children are starving. I mean, there's hierarchies exist in the real world, and they're all over the place, and we ignore them at our own risk. So, you know, self-actualization is wonderful, but, you know, if you don't have connection, you're going to be lonely. You're not going to be able to have sufficient resource to take care of somebody else. The best way for us, especially at one of those moments, you know, and I just, when you were telling me that story, I if I could have put my hand out on your shoulder at that moment, I would have, Derek. I'm telling you that, you know, to go through that without resources and just unbearably painful. And how many of us do it? How many right now today? I know, you know, a dozen people that have a dying parent. You know, the one of the women who was significant in my own life, she's in her mid to late 80s now and has Alzheimer's. I go visit her and I sit there and she just stares at the floor drooling and she has no idea who I am. And this is a person who was the mayor of the town we lived in. I mean, just brilliant, brilliant woman. And this is everywhere. You're right. You're absolutely right. There is that 9-year-old in me who was standing on the sidewalk as the cops took my mother away to prison, right? He's still in me. Now, I've done a lot of work and I've cried a lot of tears and, you know, said all the things I needed to say about that. And I can still feel the echoes of that. And I'm sure there are times when I go to do things that it impacts my decision-making, my problem-solving. So, and I have to accommodate that. You know, I'm aware of those places where I'm wounded and I have to make decisions and how I interact with other people so that that doesn't get in the way. Right? We're all making those choices. And here again, who's got the resource? Who understands how this works so that we can improve ourselves? Yeah, go ahead.
So we only have a few minutes left. And I want to bring up a couple things that Judith Herman, a couple stories from various people who've worked on trauma, Judith Herman, Robert J. Lifton, and perhaps somebody else. Excuse me. And both Robert J. Lifton and Judith Herman talked about the people who have survived. I mean, they talk about many of the things you do. That Judith Herman talks about how the first thing is to get somebody to safety, and then it's important for them to tell the trauma story and to make meaning of the trauma story, which I think is some different language for what you've been talking about. And then she also, and Robert J. Lifton talks about this too, says that the survivors who seem to do the best are those who eventually come to what she calls a survivor mission, where you take your trauma and you turn it into a gift for the community by a woman who is sexually assaulted, then becomes an active advocate for other women. And then I want to say one more thing along these lines, and then I'm going to just turn it over to you to close. And the other thing is something, I don't know if this is Judith Herman or if some other trauma expert was saying, there's a story about a woman who had a survivor mission to talk about sexual assault, and she talked about it, talked about it, talked about it. And then finally one day, the moment that she realized that she had, to use your language, sort of emptied her discharge cup on it, was one day she was giving a talk at a high school and a student asked, what's the worst thing about the rape that happened to you? What was the worst thing about when you were raped? And she gave an answer she'd never given before, which she said, it's really boring.
Yeah.
And that was the moment when she realized it no longer controlled her life, but was something simply a part of her past. So take any of that any direction you want and then close.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. So, you know, all of those pieces, and I can share one of my own stories. I did this work. I was going 2.5 hours a day for almost almost 10 months. And I was just in full empty out mode. It was just a train wreck. And I mean, I have a lot of history. You know, I'm one of those people that, had I not figured out at 19 that I was train wreck and started doing this kind of work, I'd have wound up with a 30-06 in a tower somewhere nailing pedestrians, and that just wasn't okay with me. So I did all of that, and one day I realized that I'd emptied it all out. And this is exactly what you're talking about. And I realized that my story was just one more datum. You know, anything I could say about my history was just one more piece of story that had no charge on it. I just emptied that out. And I had that. I remember sitting at a picnic table with a bunch of other people and realizing for the first time I was present in my body since I'd been a little child. First time I was present in my body, awake, aware, and alert to the experience of other people. I could actually see them out there instead of seeing my own reflected pain. And it was really remarkable. When I went to the session the next day, I still had plenty to talk about, and I was crying and crying, and it dawned on me I had tapped into the well of grief of the world. There was an endless supply, and that's the point where the person makes a choice to go, look, this goes right back to those three needs, connection, right, authenticity, contribution. Once we make the connection with ourselves, then we can start to connect other people. And by becoming who we really are, we don't have to pretend anymore. And we don't have to get lost in our own story. We have sufficient attention for other people's unmet needs, right? And then we can begin to choose to make that contribution. Reach out. This is what you're talking about. What happened to her was her story got boring. Now she's far more interested in what's your story. How can my experience help and support you in making your own self whole? And this is the driving mission. This is, you know, I think, I don't remember if you and I ever talked about this. We might have written about it. But that heart attack that I had 13 years ago, I was dead. There was, you know, I was in the ER with, you know, 14 or 15 doctors and nurses and everybody with all of their technical equipment. And I'm looking around and I'm going, this is my species. What a remarkable, remarkable group they are, right? And here I am at the end of the story of me. This is it, because I could feel my heart stop again. And I knew that this was the third time. That's it. I'm done. I'm over, right? I'm over. And I let it go. And I was so proud of the people who were in that room doing their best to take care of this, you know, old guy that they didn't even know his name. What remarkable people they were. And when I woke up, this is like a day and a half later, and I was in a hospital 2.5 hours away from where I died. And I, you know, I'd had the stent and all that other stuff. And the doctor said, well, you know, if you don't get any infections, you should be okay. You know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, a lot of damage to your heart. You're really in trouble. And here I am 13 years later. But in that shift, I realized that all I could do was do my best to make my best effort to support other people in their process. It's no longer about me. Well, I can tell the story short, but I don't have any charge on it anymore. This is exactly what what that person was saying.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Boring, you know, my story. Yeah. It happened to me, if you want to know.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've said. This has been really fantastic, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Carmen Leo. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.